Or maybe doing more exercise. Half of all Americans are officially couch potatoes. To qualify, you have to do less than 30 minutes of exercise per day. That's according to Adrian Bowman of the University of Sydney in Australia. Australians, by the way, aren't much better. And he says changing the way we live is going to take more than just individual efforts. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Adrian Bowman has made the study of physical inactivity his life's mission. He's done research on it, and he's analyzed other people's work. And one thing about modern life is clear.
We don't expend energy doing anything. We've actually engineered regular daily physical activity out of our lives.
He says a lot of things stop us from burning calories.
We come to work in almost any vocation, and we sit. And we sit for 8 hours, and then we get up and we sit in the motor car, in automobile, and we go home. When we arrive at home, we sit in front of the television. We have frozen TV dinners. We have pre-prepared, pre-packaged food that doesn't require energy to collect it. We don't hunt, cook it. It's mostly just put in microwaves and simple systems.
We don't even chop vegetables anymore. Bowman says that's very different from the way life used to be. He cites research by a colleague who studied people living and working in a historical Australian village recreating life in the 19th century.
Their energy expenditures were 3 to 5 times the amount that people spend today. And that was just a regular person going to and from work. It wasn't a lumberjack or someone who was working on the land or someone who had a huge, heavily physical job.
And of course, 3 to 5 times more energy expenditure burns a lot more calories. Today, advocates of what's termed smart growth are building communities where people at least get out of their cars. There's a project under construction at the site of the old Stapleton Airport in Denver. 7,500 people have houses and apartments there already. Alicia Brown is the director of Healthy Living for the nonprofit that's creating the community.
We have sidewalks, we have bike lanes in the community. It's very geared towards people being able to walk around the community. They can walk to the grocery store. They can ride their bikes on the trails. There are parks all throughout the community, and it encourages people to get out of their cars.
In this community, a soccer mom is on her feet. Brown says she might get her kids out of the house in the morning and walk them to the park.
While they're at the park, she can walk right across the street and have coffee. And we often see moms and their children walking and playing and exercising. There are more strollers in the Stapleton neighborhood than cars.
Studies of communities like Stapleton have confirmed that people are walking more, and researchers are studying people in these communities, comparing them to people in nearby neighborhoods to see who's healthier. What they find out will matter, says Adrian Bowman. A lot of people think that getting healthier is all about dealing with the obesity epidemic. Others think it's all about getting people to move around more. Bowman says it's both.
The exercise science community would say physical inactivity is 2/3 of the story. The nutritionists would say diet's 2/3 of the story. As a public health person, I'll say it's probably 50-50.
He cites studies from the World Health Organization and other institutions that show that inactivity takes a real toll on health.
Physical inactivity is a major risk factor for death and for illness. It contributes to about 1/6 of heart disease, cardiovascular disease, about the same for diabetes, about 12% for falls in the elderly, and about 1/10 of all breast cancer and colon cancer are attributable to being physically inactive.
Bowman says getting people up and moving is more than about just motivating individuals. He says it's going to take a coordinated effort like the one that's driven down smoking rates. And he says the payoff will be on a similar scale. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
And that's your health for this Monday morning.
Vampires are everywhere. The HBO series True Blood starts its 3rd season Sunday, and the latest Sookie Stackhouse novel is no doubt topping many readers' summer lists. Well, NPR's Margot Adler has read 100 vampire books this year, and she has reviews for us of 2 new novels, both expected to be summer blockbusters.
The most buzz is happening around The Passage by Justin Cronin. It's a brick at 766 pages with a blurb from Stephen King. A secret military experiment goes awry. The disease gets out of the lab, creates monsters, and the Earth is practically destroyed. The monsters are vampire-like in that they feed on blood, but they don't speak, and only a tiny spark of their old self remains. What makes the passage gripping is the adventures of a group of survivors who are determined to find the source of the plague destroying their world. Protected by lights that may soon fail, they venture out into the destroyed world, fighting the monsters. They encounter small groups of survivors and a mysterious, voiceless girl who may hold the key to the origins of the disaster. The plot rarely lets you down, and some of the writing is so lyrical that you feel you are in the dystopian, ravaged world. The survivors have little knowledge of the world's history, but they create new culture, new language, and new social structures. This is the first book in a trilogy and ends with a threat still out there. The passage may be almost 800 pages, but you will turn them quickly. It comes out tomorrow. The other book, also the first of a trilogy, is Blood Oath, which combines in a unique way a vampire novel and a presidential thriller. It sounds crazy, but stick with me. In 1867, in the time of President Andrew Johnson, a young man named Nathaniel Cade is attacked by a vampire while working on a whaling ship. Overwhelmed by hunger and to his own diminishing horror, he feeds on his best friend. He is imprisoned and later pardoned from a death sentence by the president, who binds him with a blood oath, compelling Cade to be a secret agent and protect all U.S. presidents. 140 years later, Nathaniel Cade is taciturn and cold, a hunter and killer who believes himself damned but is still a Christian. He wears a cross, even though it hurts. He objects to words of blasphemy and even goes to AA meetings to deal with his own bloodlust. Like Spock in Star Trek, he seems emotionally dead but fascinating. The novel begins when Cade's old handler is retiring and Zack Barrow is hired to replace him. Young, ambitious, and a Washington insider, Barrow dreams of being chief of staff. Instead, he's given this new assignment and told of a hidden world. His relationship with Cade and his growing maturity in what is clearly a bizarre and dangerous job is the most compelling aspect of the novel. The various evils, a former Nazi scientist who wants to create Frankenstein monsters, a jihadist group that wants to use such evils, a shadow CIA, all seem a bit predictable. But there is pure fun here as well, a whole bunch of pseudo-documents, including a hilarious explanation for the missing 18 minutes in the Nixon tapes. Cade has no love for humanity. His long life makes him view human foibles with some disdain. The best vampire novels struggle with moral questions. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to use power wisely? Cade struggles with his vanishing humanity, and author Christopher Farnsworth has the potential to create an even more interesting character in book two.
NPR's Margot Adler. You can find all our summer picks at npr.org/summerbooks.
Today, AT&T is making available a new pricing plan for iPhone and iPad users. It's a shift in the way that phone companies have previously charged people for the downloaded data from their mobile devices, and it could influence other companies as well. To find out more, we've reached out to Matt Buchanan. He's with the technology blog Gizmodo.com. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not sure that most of us, even those of us who may have a mobile phone with data, understand exactly how we're being charged for it. What is it that AT&T has been doing with iPhone users and iPad users?
So what they've been doing, and what most carriers have been doing in the U.S. anyway, is you'll pay around $30 a month for an unlimited amount of data. You can download as much as you want. You can upload as much data as you want.
If I'm totally obsessed and on this 12 hours a day, it's still just $30 a month.
Yep. I've heard of people going crazy downloading 20 gigabytes of data over their phone, which is a lot of data in a month. And that's part of the reason they're moving to these new pricing plans, is because their network is kind of strained by all these phones. So what they're trying to do, and what AT&T says, is that 98% of users use less than 2 gigabytes of data a month. Mm-hmm. So what they're aiming at is this top 2% of users who use a disproportionate amount of data. The top 10% of users use around 50% of all bandwidth mm-hmm. on the network, and so that's what they're really targeting. Most people, though, probably use under a couple of hundred megabytes a month. For those people, the argument is that they'll be saving $5 a month on the new data.
Because it goes down to $25 from $30, is that right?
Right. There's two new options coming up. Mm-hmm. There is a 200 megabyte plan for $15 a month, and then there is a 2 gigabyte plan for $25 a month.
Okay.
If you go over, you can get another gigabyte of data for another $10, which is actually a fairly reasonable overage fee.
What happens if I'm one of these super, super users who is downloading music videos all the time and using tons of things and reading books on my iPad and doing a million other things at once? Maybe, who knows, if it's using the NPR app, any kind of thing like that.
You'll be paying more for that data. The point is that you're going to be paying for all of the data you use. It's not an all-you-can-eat buffet anymore.
And so what's wrong with that?
Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that, actually, because network capacity is a finite resource. And so when you have a small number of users responsible for people maybe dropping calls in certain areas and this sort of thing, you understand why there's an incentive to have people use less of the network and less bandwidth when you have these phones that can do so much. But there are a couple of things going on here. If you look at the way that the pricing structure is laid out under the new plan, you're actually paying more per megabyte of data. Like if you break out how much you're paying for each byte of data, people getting the $15 a month plan are paying a lot more per byte than people on the 2 gigabyte plan and people obviously under the unlimited plan.
The bottom line is rather than a flat fee, you're getting charged a range of fees by AT&T. Other companies could plausibly follow this. And I suppose that your reporting follows on the suspicion that most of us would have. When a company goes to the trouble of messing with its price structure like this, one way or another, they're going to get more money out of us. That's why they do it, right?
Yes. A lot of people will save money initially. But the issue for me is in 6 months, 2 gigabytes of data, which for now is a lot of data for most people, mm-hmm. may not seem to be that much data, especially when you have the new iPhone coming out that can stream Pandora or NPR in the background. You'll be able to stream.
Use it as a full-service radio, basically, a music
right.
service.
The amount of data that seems like a lot today may not seem like so much tomorrow.
So basically, AT&T is setting us all up to profit later from our crack addiction.
Yes. Well, and I mean, it was, you know, this model in some ways was sort of inevitable. The all-you-can-eat buffet can only last so long because, you know, when you're talking about millions of phones downloading gigabytes of data a month, that's a huge infrastructure problem. And AT&T's just been hit the hardest by it because they've had the phone that's been most attractive for this kind of thing. You know, right now, other carriers so far are sticking with the all-you-can-eat plan. But typically in the phone industry, at least in the U.S., when one carrier makes a big move, the others follow in due time. So AT&T is really the first to move from this all-you-can-eat to paying for every pound that you eat.
Matt Buchanan writes for Gizmodo.com. Matt, thanks very much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Welcome back to the program. Deb, Renee Montaigne is away. We're going to report this morning on some of the long-term effects of a disaster. The Coast Guard commander says it will probably take until fall to completely seal a well leaking oil in the Gulf of Mexico. BP says it's making progress, but of course that's many millions of gallons after the spill began. In a moment, we'll hear what scientists are saying about the consequences far below the surface. First, we'll talk about jobs. When President Obama visited Louisiana last Friday, he got an earful about his 6-month moratorium on deep water drilling. People who depend on the oil industry say that could be a bigger economic blow than the spill itself. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The giant workboats maneuvering in the tight quarters of Port Fourchon, Louisiana, are a lifeline for the drilling rigs and oil and gas wells in the Gulf of Mexico. But Joey Marshall, who captains the HOS Mystique, worries business will plummet because of the moratorium on deep water drilling in U.S. waters.
We could be looking at a terrible downturn in our business because of a terrible downturn.
Captain Marshall is standing in the wheelhouse of his 250-foot vessel. It's bristling with high-tech electronics. This boat's computerized thrusters allow it to hover directly over a point on the ocean floor, while its remotely operated vehicles build undersea pipelines or service drilling platforms. But the captain says work could be rare in the next 6 months.
It's going to be devastating for a lot of my coworkers and family and extended family.
So you feel like you could be out of work for an extended period of time?
Yes.
And it won't be just mariners like Captain Marshall or the roughnecks on the drilling rigs who suffer, says Shane Guidry. He's chairman and CEO of Harvey Gulf International Marine. Harvey Gulf owns a fleet of boats that service deepwater platforms and ocean-going tugs that pull drill rigs to locations around the world. From the window of his office on the 37th floor of the Shell building in downtown New Orleans, Guidry points to the French Quarter in the business district below.
I tell you, it's going to be impacted by this drilling ban because this is a hub. People use this airport. People use these hotels. That's all going to stop.
There's no doubt that the oil and gas industry is the biggest player in Louisiana's economy. It accounts for about 16% of the state's GDP, according to the Tulane Energy Institute. Fishing is only 1% and tourism 4%. So, says Guidry, the effect of the moratorium will ripple out through the businesses that support oil and gas.
Guys that sell maintenance and repair, guys that sell engines. There's many banks out there who only loan money to the oil and gas sector. They're going to be affected. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Car makers, people won't be buying cars. Houses, people won't be able to buy houses. They have no jobs to pay for it.
Louisiana's Economic Development Department estimates up to 20,000 jobs could be lost in the state over the next year or so because of the drilling ban. Experts at Tulane's Energy Institute even suggest the ripple effects could cause a double-dip recession in the United States. However, an analysis by Moody'sEconomy.com disputes that conclusion. But Guidry argues the Gulf region, at least, could suffer for years. He says the big oil companies aren't going to sit in the Gulf of Mexico twiddling their thumbs while they pay $500,000 a day for leases on idle drill rigs.
I certainly wouldn't want to pay that for 6 months. While I didn't know what the government was going to do next, I'd redeploy that into another area. And once I started drilling, got comfortable in that area and started finding big finds, why come back here?
Ivor Van Heerden, who's been a strong defender of Louisiana's coastal environment for decades, is skeptical the oil companies will leave.
We've heard these sorts of things before. The oil is out there. There are fantastic deposits off coastal Louisiana and federal waters. And so I doubt they go away.
Van Heerden also points out that production from deep water and shallow water wells will continue during the moratorium, so much of Louisiana's oil and gas industry will remain busy. He says the moratorium is necessary, even if it costs some jobs, to ensure proper practices are put in place that ensure this kind of spill never happens again. That's essentially what President Obama told local officials during his visit to Grand Isle on Friday. But the president said if his commission studying the disaster issues its recommendations in less than 6 months, he'd be open to ending the moratorium early. John Idstey, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Imagine you run a nonprofit film archive, and donations of actual films on nitrate have been coming in for decades, often unlabeled. You don't have the time, the money, or the staff to go through them all, so they sit. Well, that is more or less what happened at the New Zealand Film Archive, and you won't believe what they've just found. Howie Mofshevitz of Colorado Public Radio has the story.
In the first three decades of the last century, movies were an even bigger deal than they are now. In the 1910s, people might go to a movie a day. By the 1920s, actor and filmmaker Charlie Chaplin was the most famous person in the world. Yet little evidence of that remains today, says Annette Melville, director of the nonprofit National Film Preservation Foundation.
Only about 20% of the films produced in America during the silent era, that is the era of motion pictures before 1929, survive today in the United States in complete form.
That means 80% of all the American movies made before 1929 are either completely gone or exist only in fragments. But some of these movies might just be sitting in rusting film cans, in a dusty closet, in the attic of a long-dead movie projectionist in, say, New Zealand. And that makes sense, says Frank Stark, chief executive of the New Zealand Film Archive, if you think about how movies were distributed.
Logically enough, when you look at a map, especially a flat map, we were at the end of a distribution network. By the time the nitrate film had been shipped to Asia, Australia, and then on to New Zealand, or whatever the sequence was, it was considered largely to have finished its commercial life. So the people in the States didn't want to spend the money to ship it all the way back. I believe they probably, in the main, issued instructions that they should be destroyed or thrown away.
Many of them weren't. Projectionists held on to them, collectors, all kinds of pack rats. And over the years in New Zealand, many of the prints wound up in the vaults of the National Archive, where the highly flammable nitrate film stock could be stored safely. Stark and others there found 150 American titles, about 75 of which were in good enough shape to be returned.
One of the most remarkable finds, and it's probably going to be the film everyone talks about,
says Annette Melville,
is a lost feature by American director John Ford called Upstream, and it dates from 1927, a year in which no other Ford films survive. Only about 15% of John Ford's films from the silent era survive today.
Melville says that besides Upstream, the rediscovered movies include the first film ever directed by Mabel Normand, a comic sensation of the 1910s, and a lost film called Maytime, starring the original It Girl, Clara Bow. There are also industrial films on how to make a Stetson hat or a Fordson tractor. For film historian Shelley Stamp of the University of California, Santa Cruz, those all pale by comparison to the missing reel of a film by director Lois Weber.
She made hundreds of films, over 40 feature films. In the 1910s, her name was routinely mentioned alongside D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille, names we still remember now, but she wasn't as good at sort of promoting herself and ensuring her historical legacy. But what interests me about her career is that she believed in the power of cinema to bring to life issues of the day in a way that could be digested and thought about by average citizens. So she made films on birth control, poverty, drug abuse, capital punishment, and really had a vision of a kind of socially engaged cinema.
Lois Weber is an important part of film history, but Frank Stark of the New Zealand Film Archive says all of these films are important, and that's why the archive kept them in the first place.
It really validates the basic archival impulse, which is to say that these films, until the research was done, were undifferentiated, not necessarily celebrated or by famous makers or involving famous performers. We didn't know that, and we made our commitment to keep them anyway, against the day when we could find out whether or not that was the case.
It was. John Ford's Upstream, not seen in 80 years, will be screened in Los Angeles this fall. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
As anger builds over the BP spill, environmentalists are hoping to hear a more forceful message from President Obama on climate change. They say this could provide the transformative moment for the country to commit to clean energy. Bill McKibben has been writing along these lines. His most recent book is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill McKibben, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Melissa.
You have written that President Obama has barely broken a sweat on climate change, and I'm wondering what it is exactly you have been waiting to hear him say.
We've been waiting for him, I think, to go stand there with his back against the Gulf and say, look, as ugly as that is, that black mess that BP has left us in the Gulf, even if that oil had gotten safely ashore and been refined and put in the gas tanks of your cars and burned, it would have been an environmental disaster then too. It would have driven the even larger problem that we're facing, this runaway global warming, that's really the largest challenge that he or any other president has ever come up against.
And on these three trips that he's made now to the Gulf, you're hearing something falling short of that.
Well, he's beginning to make some noises about working towards clean energy transition and things, and that's good. But if there was ever an opportunity to take this debate and change it once and for all, to do what John Kennedy did when he got us going to the moon, you know, this is that moment.
You use that example of President Kennedy's 10-year timetable to land a man on the moon, but there's a huge difference here, and that is that there are very powerful entrenched interests that have huge economic stakes in this, the oil and gas industry. Not the same with the space program.
That's why we need him to be the movement-building, campaigning Obama that we saw in the election.
I think, though, President Obama's advisors would say, look, he is going all the time to visit solar cell manufacturers, wind turbine plants. He's talking about green jobs, campaigned on that, saying
he's
that, you know, we can't sustain fossil fuel use. Isn't that the message that he's putting out all the time?
He's done way more than all the other presidents of the global warming era combined. That's not the issue. The issue is, you know, we need not just a good beginning, we need an incredible level of effort if we're ever going to overcome that incredible barrier you described, the power of the most profitable enterprise fossil fuel that the world has ever seen.
And apart from standing, as you say, with the Gulf at his back and speechifying, is there more to it that you would need to hear him do?
He needs to knock heads in the Senate. He needs to get a much sharper bill than the one that's been proposed, and then he needs to get it through. The rest of the world is waiting to see what the U.S. is going to do.
You know very well the alignment in Congress right now. I mean, they would have a hard time, I think, getting a watered-down climate change bill through right now? What makes you think they could get something stronger through?
There is no question that the political reality is difficult. The only thing tougher is the reality. I mean, we're not, in the end, debating Republicans versus Democrats. We're debating human beings versus physics and chemistry. And right now, that debate's going badly. We're losing this. And we need very much, despite the difficulties of the political reality, because of the difficulties of the political reality, that's why we need a real step up right now from our leader.
Have you been talking with the president's advisors on environmental issues?
I have not.
Do you get the sense that there's any receptiveness on their part?
I think my sense from the few people that I do talk to there from time to time, my sense is that they haven't made up their minds yet. They're making the political calculation about what's beneficial, how much they can do. But boy, this is one moment to seize the opportunity that we've been given. The Gulf is a horror show, and the only good thing that can come out of it is a real renewed commitment to deep, serious, transformative change.
Bill McKibben is the author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. He's also a scholar in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. Bill McKibben, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Take care.